This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research. Sylvia Sayer found her lifelong love in a library, bound up in a book titled What is Chemistry? The book sparked a passion that took her first to Michigan's Hope College for undergraduate studies in chemistry, and then to the University of California at Berkeley for a PhD. Sayer's work has focused on chemical reactions that happen on surfaces, and on the question of why some of these reactions occur under high pressure but fail in the lower pressures of the laboratory. Sayer has received numerous awards, including the American Chemical Society's Willard Gibbs Award, an honor that puts her in the company of Nobel laureates like Marie Curie and Linus Pauling. Sayer was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1997. She currently holds the John C. Sheehan Chair in Chemistry at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Sayer was interviewed by Gisela Tellis in 2007.
How did you first become interested in science?
I was finally able to go to the library when I was about 11 years of age. And it's interesting, I say finally was able to go to the library because my parents were actually very worried about signing up their children to get a library card. And the reason they were worried was because of their own experiences in communist or such countries. And they were quite worried about having their children's name on a list. And it took them quite a few years to be comfortable with that, to allow us to either be a brownie or a Girl Scout, or to get a library card so you could go into the library. They had very tumultuous lives, and as young people, and they were scared, and so it took a while for them to settle down. But when I finally got that library card, on the library shelf was a series of books, and the books were all entitled What is Something? So it's called the What Is It series. And this, of course, is in the middle 60s or so. And there were a lot of different books. What is a plant? What is a solar system? What is a star? And they were all some color in white striped. It's multicolor books, you know, not very thick. There was one book that was, the way I read it, What is Chemistry? I mean, I was pronouncing it as the CH, as I was told to pronounce it, and the word came out, chemistry. And so that is what intrigued me, is the strangeness of the word. And inside the book, I found this wonderfully logical pattern. That is, we could build up different elements by changing the number of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And electrons at that point went in circular orbits, and these orbits got larger and larger as the element got more massive. It was just so logical and you know, analytical. I could understand it. It made sense. And that was it. I was going to be a chemist.
You thought about college, and what did you look for?
Not having had parents who've had an experience growing up in the United States, I really didn't have a lot of advice about colleges. And so my main concern really was being close to home. And so I think I applied to two colleges. One is the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And the other college was Hope College in Holland, Michigan. My high school chemistry teacher had spent a summer at Hope College in an NSF-sponsored summer session for high school teachers who teach a second year of high school chemistry or an advanced placement type of chemistry. And he was so taken by his experience there during the summer and taken by the opportunities that the undergraduates had to just do hands-on research, because this is a small college where you don't have graduate students and you can get into the laboratory. It was really at his suggestion that I knew of Hope College and eventually went there, convinced that I would have that opportunity to get in the lab myself and you know, make things happen for myself. And I'm very glad I did. I have to say that it was really by examples of my Hope College professors that I learned to be a professor from the standpoint of classroom education or one-on-one education. That was a very valuable experience. So yes, that's where I learned to teach. I spend a lot of time at my teaching, which isn't always in my best interest. You know, sometimes I don't spend enough time with my graduate students because, you know, I'm preparing a lecture that isn't, you know, quite the way I want it to be. It takes a lot of thought, and also it takes you being able to see yourself as your students would see it, as your students would see you, to understand whether or not you're going to really get something across. I mean, it takes time to think that all through. Teaching is a big effort. It takes a lot of time. And there's always conflicting pressures between that and research and a lot of service work that everyone seems to want you to do.
How do you balance all of that out?
Well, I am by no means a good example of that. You know, I do the best I can. Oftentimes, I put aside my research in order to do the teaching when I'm teaching. But then, as soon as I finish teaching, I really work hard on you know, picking up where I left off with my graduate students and writing a proposal. And you know, quite honestly, you know, when I'm teaching, although I'm focusing on that, I am worrying about the fact that I'm not doing my research. And when I'm doing my research, then I'm worrying about the fact that I'm not doing the committee assignment that somebody else wants me to do. So, you know, to say that I balance this isn't an accurate statement. There's a lot of time worrying. The question that really intrigued me when I was in graduate school and that served as the motivation for my work as an independent investigator at MIT was I wanted to understand why many of these catalytic reactions that are so important just to U.S. industry worked under what are known as catalytic conditions, which are very high pressure conditions, but didn't seem to work in the laboratory, which are very low pressure conditions. So, for example, if you try to make the steam reforming reaction work under laboratory conditions, it won't work. The steam reforming reaction is the reaction of methane plus water to make CO and hydrogen. And it is the commercial reaction for the production of hydrogen. And so if you're talking about a hydrogen economy, you're talking about producing the hydrogen from steam reforming of methane. And this is a reaction that happens where the methane and the water adsorb, stick to a nickel surface, and the nickel is the catalyst. And the bottom line is that if you take the nickel surface and you stick a methane molecule on it and you stick a water molecule on it in the laboratory, and you're doing it under low pressure conditions, that is, the pressures of the methane and the water are 10 to the minus 5 torr, and you know, that translates to about 10 to the 0.001 atmospheres, say. If you're doing it under those kinds of conditions, the methane and the water, they won't react. You won't see any products. But you know you can see the real products because there are plants, steam reforming plants, all over the country, where they have methane, a mixture of methane and water, and they pass it over a nickel catalyst, but they're passing it over a nickel catalyst when the pressures are 100 atmospheres, so 100 times atmospheric pressure, as opposed to the laboratory conditions, which are, you know, 0.001 of atmospheric pressure. So at 100 atmospheres, the reaction works. In the laboratory, that reaction doesn't work. And what I wanted to know was why that was the case. Why should the pressure of the gas above this nickel surface have anything to do with whether or not the reaction made products, which was carbon monoxide and this hydrogen? And that was the question that I wanted to answer. It required building of very sophisticated apparatus. The machine that we built had two molecular beams, and a molecular beam is nothing other than a tube with a plate welded on the end and a small pinhole. And what we do is we take gas molecules behind the pinhole and we let those molecules expand into a vacuum. So we make a beam of molecules. That's what a molecular beam is. And then we direct them at a surface. And then what happens is that the molecules hit the surface, they do what they do, and then they scatter back from the surface. And then out here, away from the surface, we have a detector of some kind that will detect those scattered molecules. That detector will rotate around the surface, so that we can measure the angular distribution of the molecules that are scattered from the surface. And we can also measure the energy distribution of the molecules scattered from the surface. And from that, we can work backwards and determine something about the motions and the dynamics of that interaction with the surface. So I learned some mechanical engineering, or a lot of mechanical engineering, drafting. So we do a lot of drawings, and then we get it to a machine shop, and they make the pieces. We put it all together and finally try to do an experiment and make an experiment work. So it was quite different from any of my undergraduate experiences. Berkeley is very hilly and beautiful, just lush and green, and it just there's an aroma in the air, which is from a lot of flowering plants. You know, I was just awed just by the nature of the on the campus and around the campus. But Berkeley is a very big place. There is a very big place, and it's a big contrast to Hope College. I think you really do have to advocate for yourself. You don't have a group of faculty who is kind of watching after you. It was different.
How many other women were in graduate school in the chemistry program at that time?
At that time? There were a few of us. I would say the Berkeley incoming class had about 90 students in there. I think there were probably 6 or 7 of us, if I remember correctly.
Did you encounter any sense of why are you here building these things when you were in the lab?
Yes, I had a lot of trouble in graduate school. Some of it came from dealing with the machine shop. There are individuals in the machine shop who probably aren't so enlightened, and they were certainly not used to working with women, and it was hard. Oftentimes in a design, there's give and take, and there were a couple of individuals who just wouldn't give. There was also, I think, a little bit of difficulty because I was giving these guys, and they were guys, drawings, and, you know, essentially saying, this is what I want, and I think they had a little bit of difficulty. So it was hard to get the machine built. There's no question about it.
How did you deal with it?
Persistence. You know, some of the things that went on, you know, at that time you just took it because, hey, that's the way it was. But I think if the same sorts of incidents happened today, you would really would have institutional recourse to try to address them. It was not a pleasant experience, to say the least. One of my research advisors was particularly helpful. Tried to arrange things so that it wouldn't be so difficult. Also made some room in his laboratory for me to work while some other things cooled down. I think also, during that time, a lot of the time I thought it was my fault and my problem. And, well, okay, if it's my fault, my problem, I'll just work harder. And, you know, that served me well, although in retrospect I can see that, although certainly, there were things that I could have done differently to smooth things over, it really wasn't my fault. But that's all in retrospect. The question I wanted to answer was why the pressure of the molecules made such a big difference in their chemistry. And, you know, in thinking about it, I actually had a hypothesis of what was going on. The hypothesis had to do with there being an activation energy barrier. That is, let's take methane. Methane is a tetrahedral molecule. There's a carbon in the center, and there's hydrogens pointed to the four corners of a tetrahedron. And what happens is that when that molecule comes into the nickel surface, if it's coming very slowly, that molecule will just bounce off of that surface. What that molecule will not do is fall apart. And in order for that molecule to start to do any chemistry, it's got to fall apart. You have to break the first CH bond. This goes back to the steam reforming reaction of methane plus water to make CO and hydrogen. Well, if you're going to take the methane, which is CH4, and make CO, which is CO, you're going to have to pull off all the hydrogens. So the very first step has to be that carbon-hydrogen bond has to break. But if this methane molecule is coming into the surface very slowly, it's just going to bounce off of the surface. What you have to do is you have to take that molecule and accelerate it into the surface. and you have to accelerate it. You have to make it go fast so that when it collides with the surface, that molecule gets squashed. The hydrogens get pushed back. And that carbon that's stuck in the center of this tetrahedron, it gets close enough to the nickel to start to form a carbon-nickel bond. And then the hydrogens form a nickel-hydrogen bond. And it's only when you start to form the nickel-carbon and nickel-hydrogen bond, then that finally that CH bond is going to break. And when the CH bond breaks, then you have a CH3 stuck to the nickel and a hydrogen stuck to the nickel. And that's the first step in the dissociation of the methane. That takes energy. You know, you have to have a lot of energy for that methane molecule to go splat, is what we call it. Kind of splat chemistry, right? And that energy is what I refer to as the activation energy barrier. Now, how does that relate to pressure? Well, molecules in a gas have a distribution of energies. And the distribution is such that you have a lot of molecules that have low energy and few molecules that have high energy. So if you have low pressure, most of the molecules are coming in at low energy. You have a few that are up there at high energy, but there's so few that the rate at which they dissociate is so slow, you don't have enough to measure them. But if you're at high pressure, well, the fraction of molecules in the high energy is just as small as it was at low pressure, but you just have many more of them. And so by increasing the pressure, you're increasing the number of molecules that have that higher energy, and therefore, you're increasing the rate of the reaction, and the reaction goes. And it's all related to the energy that you need to kind of deform that methane molecule, to make it go splat. But you can't just have an idea, you have to prove it. Right? And so, proving that gives you a handle to know how to make these reactions work under the laboratory conditions. And then actually when we saw that we could make methane fall apart on the surface by accelerating it and letting it go splat, then we said, well, we could maybe do the following experiment. We could cool the surface down. So say, to liquid nitrogen temperatures, or maybe a little bit below, like 50 degrees Kelvin. And then we can freeze methane on the surface at really low temperatures, so it'll stick as this tetrahedral molecule can freeze it. And then if the key to making it dissociate is to deform it, then we can take a hammer to it. We can take a hammer to it. We can essentially hit it, and then it'll fall apart. And so, well, we took a hammer. And the hammer is we took an inert gas atom, and we accelerated it, and we directed it at this methane molecule. And we could make the methane fall apart. We have some papers called Chemistry with a Hammer.
What are some obstacles that you think you've encountered, or you feel you've encountered over the course of your scientific career? They can be personal or professional.
I, at least, have found it very difficult to balance life as an academic and a personal life. So, I do not have a spouse, I do not have a family, and although I think when I was in graduate school, I did think that once I went to an academic institution and got tenure, then I would have time to take care of that part of my life. That never happened. And it never happened because the demands are just so great. And now that isn't to say that it can't happen for women. I do think you can have it all. And there are certainly many younger women now that do. But maybe because of the time at which, you know, which would have been the 80s for me, maybe because that time it just wasn't so common. I couldn't, you know, it didn't happen to me. Maybe because I'm not really good at compromising. You know, I couldn't make it happen. Maybe it's a, you know, just a personal, you know, a difficulty particular to me, and maybe other women, I couldn't make it happen. And, you know, there's some regrets there, in the sense that I really love children. I have two nephews that, you know, I absolutely adore. But they're certainly not my children. And, you know, I wish that could have been different. And I certainly hope that for a younger generation of women that it will be different. And as I said, I think it is changing. I think it is changing slowly. You know, that said, I also know what a struggle it is for my male colleagues to maintain an active research group, which is really pushing the frontiers of science to stay at the cutting edge and to, you know, and to maintain their family life too. It's difficult all around. I wish it wouldn't be so difficult, but it is.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.